Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. So before we jump in, first, I'd like to wish a happy 4th of July weekend to our American listeners. Hopefully you're either off work today as we're recording this, or if you are forced to be at work, hopefully you're at least being afforded the dignity you deserve as a human by your customers. For our overseas listeners, I also want to give a special thank you. I was reading our download numbers earlier today, and it really just struck me that we do have a pretty significant number of consistent listeners in places like Great Britain or the UK. I never know what to call it. Australia, a lot of the English-speaking world, we have some consistent listeners. So thank you guys very much, and thank you to everyone who listens to the show, regardless of where you are. Makes us feel really good, makes us more encouraged that people are enjoying what we make. So that being said, this is Beyond the Breakers. I am your host, one of your hosts, Tanner. So again, thank you for your support. We like making something that people want to listen to. We're on social media. We love hearing your feedback, your comments, things like that. We're on Twitter at @beyond_breakers. We're on Instagram at @beyondthebreakerspodcast. Our email is beyondthebreakerspod@gmail.com. And we do have a Patreon for the show. That is at patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. The show will always be ad-free. We don't want to read ads. You don't want to hear ads. But that Patreon is there if you think that what we do is worth a few bucks. That money just goes back into making the show, web hosting fees, research material, whatever it may be, things that increase the quality of the program. So with all that being said, I think I must, at this point, introduce my co-host, Taylor. Taylor, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good. Enjoying a day off from work. Ready to do this thing. Looks like you got another unique story for us that's bigger than just a shipwreck. So that's always fun. I always like the creativity you put into picking our topics.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. This is also a unique episode because I think this is the most time we've spent talking before we recorded an episode.
Yeah, we definitely wasted like an hour and a half just talking about random stuff before we recorded it.
talked about baseball, talked about geography. Culture.
Accents, culture of the Midwest of the United States.
All kinds of good stuff.
All those things.
Actually good to warm up the voice.
So. Yeah, no, it feels good. Warm up the brain a little bit. Thinking pretty good here.
All right. So, I guess we should jump in here. There's a wide range of time this episode could take to record, so we'll just start now to be safe. Start with some background information.
All right.
The year is 1848. Mm-hmm. We're at Sutter's Mill, California.
Okay. I have heard of that place.
It's probably triggering some memories of a elementary school textbook on American history. In this year, at this place, gold is discovered at Sutter's Mill, triggering what we now know as the California Gold Rush. Also, I just want everyone to know that in my head, every time I say the word gold, I'm picturing, do you remember those old, those Fox News commercials with Gordon Liddy?
Yes.
Selling gold.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly how I'm saying the word to myself every time it comes up. So anyway, gold is discovered. This triggers the gold rush. And as probably most of us know, this causes a huge influx of people to California. Everyone going out trying to kind of get their own piece of the pie. It's really well documented in the Ken Burns documentary, The West. Mm-hmm. That's really good. It's kind of old at this point, but that's a pretty good documentation of it.
I feel like also like the Oregon Trail, like that's what we're talking about here, right? Like oxen and wagons and that kind of thing.
For the most part. So like at the beginning of this, the early days, before there's really a huge infrastructure built up for this purpose, a lot of people are doing that. They're putting together a wagon train and getting all their stuff together and going over land to California. And then as this kind of becomes something that everyone sees as catching on, we know any good entrepreneur, businessman is going to see this as an example to make some money. Saying all these people are going to California. If we could set up something else, another way to get them there faster, that helps everyone. Later, this does develop. There's more of a established route of taking steamships down to Panama, crossing the isthmus, and going up to California.
And I guess to be clear, like this is pre-Panama Canal. So like you're literally trekking overland to get to the Pacific.
Yes. So primarily, we're going to be talking about the year 1857. So this is before we have the Panama Canal, anything like that. There's definitely an overland aspect to this trip. So let's go to August 20th, 1857. I'm going to pull a fake out here because usually when we mention a date, something bad happens, but not here.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, right?
The SS Sonora departed San Francisco for Panama City with around 600 passengers aboard.
Okay.
So in addition to this, you've got about 3 tons of gold.
It's a lot of gold.
A lot of gold. Like, that's more gold than I have, certainly.
Yeah.
More gold than I think any of our listeners have.
If you do have that much gold, subscribe to our Patreon.
Yes, if you have that much gold, there's no reason for you to not subscribe to our Patreon at either the $3 or $5 tier. That's about $49 million in today's money.
It's a lot of money.
I finally did the conversions this time. I think the last two episodes I've cheaped out on doing my research. So this gold is in the form of some newly minted double eagle coins, some $20 coins. It's in ingots and various other forms of gold.
Did the other forms include Dogecoin?
I certainly hope so. I mean, if they were doing their homework, then yeah, they would have just loaded up with Doge, just a hold full of Doge. So on arrival in Panama, passengers disembarked, boarded the train to carry them across the isthmus to what is now Colón for the next leg of the trip. So far, so good. Everything's going fine. No problems. This could be a 9-minute episode. But when they board their next vessel to take them the rest of the way, that is the SS Central America.
Hey, we're finally onto the title ship of this show.
We are onto the title ship now, so we know it's about to get good.
Yeah, I was going to say nothing bad happened and it made its journey.
That'd be a terribly boring podcast. Just a podcast about like successful transportation instances. Just a podcast about like every successful flight that Southwest Airlines has ever completed. So an interesting detail I thought about this time period. So these ships that are transporting these people back and forth from the West Coast across Panama and back to the East Coast, they're operating not as entirely private endeavors. They're operating in conjunction with the federal government on a mail contract. So they're technically, I guess, under the jurisdiction of like the post office. I don't know what I don't know what the structure of that was in 1857. But that's kind of the contract that they're working on. So because they're working in conjunction with the U.S. government, these are civilian craft, but they're captained and manned by U.S. Navy personnel.
Interesting.
So you've got civilian liners operating with, honestly, really experienced people, probably more so than they might be captained by otherwise. So the captain on this voyage was William Herndon, who's a really interesting maritime figure. Now, and at the time, he had made a name for himself exploring in the Amazon, exploring up the Amazon River, which at the time was still pretty wild country. So a little bit about the ship itself, though. Central America was a wooden-hulled sidewheel steamer, originally named the George Law. 278 feet long, a beam of 40 feet, and she had two iron paddle wheels on her sides. I wasn't quite sure what this looked like, but the paintings that they have of it, it's pretty interesting-looking ship. It's very flat. The structure of the ship is very flat. It does have masts for sails, and then you have these two big iron wheels on the side. So very interesting looking ship.
It's an interesting time for shipping because you're kind of in that transitional phase where like ships that only use like sail are old, but like we don't have steamships in the way that we think of like steamships later on, like the Titanic or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're in this like in between like transitional phase, kind of, I guess, where we would be at with like cars nowadays with like hybrids and stuff like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's still gasoline powered, but it's also electric powered and it's sort of a in between type thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in terms of power and then also in terms of the transition from wooden held vessels to ones primarily made of steel, like that's sort of happening at this time also. So a lot of interesting things from a ship design standpoint. If that's your interest here. Very interesting time. So let's talk about the final voyage of the Central America. I was not able to get a really solid date of when it was constructed and how long it operated. Sometime in the early 1850s it was built, and I'm just assuming it ran kind of a similar route as to what it does here. So on its final voyage, the ship departed from Cologne on September 3rd of 1857, carrying 477 passengers and 101 crewmen. Destination was New York City. There was a scheduled stop in Havana. Importantly for the story, she was also carrying about $2 million in gold. That's $2 million in 1857 money, that is about $300 million today.
That's a lot of gold.
There were other estimates that I saw. I think probably the best estimate is around $400 million. I saw as high as $550 million in terms of what it was actually carrying at the time, somewhere in that range. Regardless, that is a lot of money. A lot of money that is, yeah, it's gonna make it safely to the place it's going, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing bad's going to happen. However, as the ship is making its way north, there's a hurricane developing in the Atlantic. This storm would be at a Category 2 when it finally caught up to the Central America off the coast of the Carolinas on September 9th.
I see that they're using the El Faro method of hurricane avoidance.
They are at least technically going away from it. And it like catches up with them. So I guess
they also don't have like satellite radar telling them
right, where the hurricane is. Right. No one is putting a phone in Captain Herndon's face and being like, dude, look, literally just read the weather report. Your reports are 48 hours old. So it catches up to the ship off the Carolinas. And so for about 2 days, the ship is kind of just getting tossed around in this. It's obviously staying afloat, but it's not really getting anywhere. It's kind of just being thrown around in the waves by this storm. And there are other ships out in this same storm. Like you just mentioned, this is well before the days where we could really predict things like this. You know, certainly no, you know, radar or anything like that. Even meteorological predictions are pretty rough in terms of this.
Right.
So on the 11th, the ship begins to take on water through its drive shaft and some windows that are either open or broken. So this will eventually result in the engines being flooded and disabled. You can't light the boilers. You can't run these engines. And also, like you just talked about, this is kind of mixed technology era. These ships have engines run by these boilers, but they also do have sails. At this point, the sails have basically just been shredded by the wind that they've been experiencing.
So like so many of our stories, there's no propulsion at this point, and the ship is just dead in the water, and that's not somewhere you want to be when you're in a hurricane.
Yeah, at this point, this really is just trying to survive, but not really having anything that you can do to make that happen.
Right.
So at 11 a.m. on the same day, all of the male passengers on board are enlisted to aid in forming a bucket brigade to help with bailing water. So the ship begins to list strongly to starboard, which prompts Captain Herndon to order passengers to the other side of the ship to balance it out.
Can you imagine either of these things happening nowadays? First off, like you're just a regular guy on the boat and they're like, hey, grab a bucket. Come on, you're coming with us. And then the other thing being like, you're just the passengers and they're like, hey, we're listing pretty bad. Go stand on the other side of the vessel. Like that has to be a kind of a scary moment when you're like, this shouldn't be happening.
Just be like, I kind of have a Zoom call I'm waiting on, so...
It's actually like, have you ever flown on a small airplane and they have to like move people around and get the weight right? And you're kind of like, is this like, really like that's where we're at? That like you have to shift 180 pounds over because a person? Like, I don't know if I want to do this.
Yeah, I'm regretting getting on this vessel in the first place. But here, so we're trying to balance things out, trying to counteract this list. The ship stays afloat until the following day, but again, it can't really do anything. At 1 p.m. on Saturday, this is the 12th, another ship approaches the crippled Central America. This is the brig Marine.
It's a good name for a brig.
It is. It's a solid name for any sort of vessel. So now that there's basically some sort of aid in sight, this is when Captain Herndon decides to order the women and children to get ready for boarding the lifeboats. A lot of the time in the stories that we tell, lifeboats almost seem kind of unimportant. Because it often seems like by the time you need them, they're unable to use or they can't be deployed properly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely the idea of like you've either waited too long or the conditions are just impossible.
Mm-hmm. Here we actually have a bright spot in the story. Like if there's a bright spot in the story, it's this. 153 passengers are successfully transferred to the Marine in lifeboats. Everything seems to go smoothly. This seems to be kind of a lull in the storm, according to all these accounts. So, I mean, the captain pretty astutely takes advantage of that and says, well, if we're going to get people off, now is the time to do this. So this goes off seemingly without a hitch. I didn't read of any sort of issues that came up when this happened. So all these passengers, these women and children, are transferred over to the Marine. So as the wind picks back up again, no more lifeboat transfers were possible, and the ship is pulled further away from any of the vessels trying to assist.
So is it possible? I mean, obviously, we don't know meteorologically, like, what's going on, but, like, is it possible that they passed through the eye of the hurricane, and that's why they had that lull, and then the storm gets bad again? I mean, anecdotally, it seems like that's what happened.
It's possible. I mean, that could have been. I feel like by this point, we had enough of an understanding of hurricanes that that probably would have been noted in, like, the reports about it. But I don't know. Whatever happened, it was some sort of lull, some sort of low point in the intensity of the storm. It doesn't say that it was, like, calm, but it was at least feasible enough to get some people over. So yeah, that's a really good question. And there may be an answer somewhere in some of the reports. So by this point, the schooner El Dorado has also arrived to attempt to assist. At this point, Captain Herndon relays his estimated position to the El Dorado and then urges the other ship away because it's getting dark to say, just get away until daylight and then we can revisit this. That estimated position, that was relayed verbally. So this was one ship coming up along the other, and the captain basically just
shouting it across.
Someone shouting this across, which is really impressive, I guess, that this information was able to be relayed in these conditions. So just after 8 p.m. on the 12th, SS Central America finally sank.
No fake out this time. That was specifics and a sinking.
Yes. So I'm going to quote here from A California Gold Rush History by Q. David Bowers. Q. David Bowers is a leading numismatist. Seems like he's one of the giants of the industry in America.
So what does that mean exactly?
Someone who studies coins.
Okay.
If you need some numismatism done, call this guy. So quoting from his book, A California Gold Rush History. Quote, a few minutes past 8 p.m., a tremendous wave hit the SS Central America. She shuddered, timbers broke, and with hundreds of men huddled at the front of the ship and Captain Herndon on the starboard paddle box, she slipped at a sharp angle beneath the waves. Many, including Herndon, went down with the ship, while others clung to wreckage or bobbed about in hollow tin or cork-filled life preservers. So,
doesn't sound pleasant.
It doesn't, and this actually, I learned something important from this. I did not know that they used to make life preservers with tin.
I did not know that either. I knew cork.
I had a hard time nailing down what these actually looked like. I couldn't really find a good picture of it. But I guess tin is light enough that if it's hollow and full of air, it will, I guess, float enough to support a human. I also don't think these were entirely made of tin. I think they had elements of tin in them. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was very interesting to find out.
Yeah, that was. I definitely didn't know about that.
Like, cork makes sense. Tin?
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't have thought of that. So in all, 425 people died in the sinking of the Central America. Again, as horrendous as the tragedy is with that number of people dying, I think here is where we sort of have to step back and sort of take the good that is able to be taken. The value of being able to remove all of those people, predominantly women and children, in such a well-executed and well-timed deployment of lifeboats, that is a sort of a legacy of Captain Herndon. A lot of people survived that would not have survived if he had waited a little bit longer or if he had tried too early to do that.
I think it's good, too, because it shows his willingness to do it. Whereas how often have we seen captains have opportunities to save part of the crew or all of the crew and not take it? Mm-hmm. I think he realized how dangerous the situation was and hey, this is the window that we have and we need to do what we need to do.
This is a really great example of just quick decision making, where you know what you have to do and finding the right time to do it. That's a really impressive part of this story. 50 people were rescued from the water by a Norwegian vessel called the Ellen over the subsequent span of about 8 hours.
I am happy to point out that we will put out the good along with the ramming of Norwegian vessels. This Norwegian vessel did a good thing. It didn't run into another ship and it actually saved people. So go Norway.
Norway is back in the good graces of the podcast.
Also, how many Norwegian vessels are there that they're able to work themselves into every story? We randomly pick these stories to some degree, and yet every story we seem to find a Norwegian vessel.
Yeah, it really is. It's kind of it's something that I haven't explicitly researched, but it really just the amount of times they come up in these, like you said, pretty randomly chosen stories, it really sort of demonstrates the level of influence that Norwegian vessels have on shipping, the presence that they have at this time.
Yeah. Yep.
So several more survivors were picked up about a week later in a lifeboat. That's kind of a whole survival story in itself. I couldn't find a lot of stuff immediately about this. I would like to read a little bit more about this, but you have this group of people surviving for about a week on the open sea in a lifeboat. That is impressive.
Yeah, that is.
So let's get into a little bit of the aftermath. We've covered the lead up. We've covered the actual sinking of the vessel. And strangely enough,
I honestly feel like this is where the story gets really interesting.
Yeah, strangely enough for a story like here, this is where the story really, like, it just turns it up to 11 kind of in terms of human interest. So the sinking of the Central America was a momentous story at its time. I saw a lot of comparisons to something like the Titanic, you know, for its day. This was a big deal. A lot of people, a lot of gold. This was a really, really big news story. But
yeah, I feel like with like a headline, you can always run the headline of like ship of gold sinks off the Carolinas. Like people are going to pick up that newspaper.
Yeah. Anytime you can call something a ship of gold is a good thing for a newspaper writer. So it's a big deal. But again, as a reminder of when this is happening, this happens in 1857. Mm-hmm. So this is a time in American history where obviously you can't look back in retrospect and say that this was inevitable, but a lot of things are happening in the country that are leading directly to the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So not too long after this, you know, much, much bigger things are on people's minds. I'm assuming for the average American, you know, a ship full of gold sinking probably doesn't affect you as much as violence in the streets if you live in somewhere like Kansas, or, you know, talk of secession if you live in like a border state or something like that.
Right.
So yeah, it's quickly overshadowed by the Civil War, and it doesn't really get talked about that much after the fact. Because again, this is noteworthy for both the how many people were lost and the financial impact of so much gold. And this leads us into the Panic of 1857. So I'm quoting from Lawrence Stone. I actually used him quite a bit, one of his articles in making the research for the show. So from Stone, quote, "This news contributed to the collapse of many already weakened banks. By mid-October, all but a handful of the country's banks had suspended specie payments of gold for paper money. Hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs, and in 1857, the federal treasury ran a deficit for the first time in a decade." Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the immediate aftermath. This is October. The ship sinks in September. A note, though, because like this is one of the things that honestly caught my attention about this. You'll see that it, quote, contributed to the Panic of 1857. An important thing to note about that is that the sinking of the Central America did not single-handedly cause this. It's kind of like an interesting sensationalist way to present it, but that's not really what happened.
I think it's sort of like how gas prices sometimes will bounce on, like, Iranian, you know, fast attack vessels are harassed an oil tanker, mm-hmm. in, you know, the Middle East. And you'll see gas prices spike because of that. Mm-hmm. Sort of the same thing here, that it's just one more factor. When there's a whole bunch of macroeconomic factors working, this kind of puts like an easy thing to pin it on to be like, well, the ship of gold sank, so inflation. When there's so much more going on than just that.
Yeah, this really highlights, like, the number of factors in play. You know, at the time, obviously, there's already things developing here. I was reading an article specifically about the Panic of 1857. And it's very obvious, like, this is kind of a road that you're on, regardless of what happens, just based on how people are behaving, the fickle nature of, you know, the economy in general. So no, this did not like directly lead to the panic. Right. But it was a contributing factor.
I think it's always important to remember too how dynamic world events are as they're happening. Like, it's easy in retrospect to look back at things and pin them on something, but nothing's happening in a vacuum necessarily. Like, there's just so many different dynamics in play that if you could figure out macroeconomics, you would be a rich person.
Right.
But, like, there's a reason we study it.
Yeah. And in one article specifically, it mentioned that, like, the sinking of the ship did not directly affect prices in any way, at least not directly. So again, as we know, like, investment and things like that, it just takes one or two people to panic. And then everyone says, well, why is this person panicking? I'm going to panic also. And that's how you get the Panic of 1857. I saw a lot of comparisons of this to the 2008 financial crisis.
Interesting. Been there, done that.
Which I don't know enough about economics to understand, but that's there.
I was in business school in college when that happened, so I know far more than I care to.
All right. So those are some of the economic factors of this. Let's talk about discovery of the wreck and its salvage.
All right.
So this ship goes down and no one really knows exactly where it is. Obviously, from some of the other vessels around that were witness or party to this event, there was always a general idea. But again, it was one of those things where even if you knew exactly where it sank, there would not have been any way to recover this. This sank in an area that's quite deep. If someone wanted to try and recover this vessel in the 1870s, tough. I mean, there's nothing you can do to get it. But in 1985, the Columbus America Discovery Group was formed to locate and recover the Central America. So at this point, obviously, there's been a lot of significant progress in things like sonar technology. You've got remotely operated vehicles that you can use to go down and investigate things that you find. It's a much, much better time to try and discover and salvage a deep water shipwreck. There was a general knowledge about where the ship had sunk. But again, given the depth of the general area, which is about a mile and a half.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty deep.
It had not been ever identified, obviously. Like, up to that point, there's not a huge amount of technology that's able to go that deep and discover these things. On the upside, you know, looking back, the depth did protect it from things like casual divers, you know, people who might not be as respectful of the site itself, and also protected it from the elements. I hadn't really thought about this, but the deeper it is, obviously, the more protected it is from things like storms and hurricanes, surface level damage. And to get started with this, there's a lot of math and calculations that went into determining like where this could be located. It was really interesting. I'm not really a math person unless there's some, I guess, goal behind it. I always like the word problems best, I think, in school, because right. Like at least there's a story behind this. So this, I was actually able to read through a lot of the math here, and I understood maybe half of it. I'll share a detailed article about that on Patreon, about what exactly went into all of this, these calculations. But in general, I'll just go through some of the strategies that were used to calculate these things. There were three main location strategies. Again, they have a big area they're working with. We're dealing with the open ocean. You've got to deal with things like current and drift. And then you also have to deal with where these calculations and estimations come from. There's the human element also. So three main strategies, three main scenarios that they use. The first of them was based on the position given by Captain Herndon to the captain of the Eldorado. So if you remember a few minutes ago, we talked about how a little bit before the ship goes down, the captain's able to verbally relay information to the Eldorado. And he gives them his calculated position, his most recent one that he has calculated. So some of the sources note that this would have been calculated with a potential error due to the conditions, or it just might not have been very recent. He may have just been giving them his best guess based on his most recent calculation. That could have been several hours earlier. It's estimated that he took this measurement around 7 a.m. That would have been about 12 hours before the ship went down, was his last recorded calculated measurement of their location. That's scenario one. That's the first piece of information they're working with. The second is based on the position of the Marine when it sighted Central America. So if you remember, Marine is the ship that these women and children were transferred to. The Marine had taken a celestial fix at 6 a.m. on Friday. That's the day before this happens. For most of the time between then and the sinking of Central America, this ship was basically drifting under little or no sail. And then also taking into account is the distance that the ship was from the Central America when they made their estimate. So a lot of things in play. The last scenario, the last piece of information included, is a celestial fix taken by the Ellen, that Norwegian ship that picked up some survivors. That was 8 a.m. on Sunday morning. So this is the day after the ship sinks. This is while the Ellen is recovering survivors. They take a celestial fix of their position. So we basically have three important pieces of information that need to be sort of triangulated and compared. So what they did, what this search team did, they made a composite probability map based on the likelihood of each scenario and the information it included. So both what does it say and also how much can we trust this information based on the elements. That map, actually, I will share probably on Instagram, I guess. It's a really interesting thing to look at. So quoting again from Stone, quote, "As an example, the position estimated by Captain Badger, a passenger on the Central America, was very consistent with the Ellen scenario. Lieutenant Matthew Maury made an estimate of the location of the wreck based on the information that he'd collected in his report to the Secretary of the Navy. This position also supported the Ellen scenario. The celestial fix on which the Ellen scenario was based was taken after the storm had passed on a ship that was in no danger of sinking. This position was written in the ship's log. By contrast, Herndon's position, on which the Central America scenario was based, was passed verbally to the El Dorado in the middle of a storm shortly before the Central America sank.
So that makes sense, though, that the Ellen's data would be more precise and more thought out if it's done under no duress.
Right. Yeah, obviously it makes more sense that, the ship would have a better ability to chart its location when it's not, you know, about to sink.
Yeah, for sure.
So based on those, I don't know exactly what went into the probability calculations. A statistics person would probably understand this better. They basically made probability calculations for each scenario and basically how much they could trust each of these estimates. So Central America, the Captain Herndon's estimate, was given a 23% weight. Ellen, as we just said, the calmest, probably the most rationally taken measurement, was given a 72%. And the estimate from the Marine was given 5%. So after this, they developed a search plan, and they started looking in these different areas. It would take several years of searching, but it was eventually successful.
Interesting.
The ship was found in 1988, about 160 miles off South Carolina.
It's pretty amazing that they were able to find this vessel. I mean, technology has come a long way since 1988. And also, just like, you didn't have a good fix for where this vessel was. Like, you were working with anecdotal evidence from over 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
it's pretty impressive.
And this next bit will make more sense to listeners once you take a look at the probability map that we'll share on social media. So with all this information, they sort of charted higher and lower probability areas that this ship could be in, that they needed to look. It was actually found outside one of their high probability areas, or an injunction area, they call it. Again, we'll share that map so you know what that means. The first big clue that they discovered was the two large iron side wheels. So, of course, Central America wasn't the only ship designed like this, but finding it within their general search area was a pretty big clue. Like, this is probably the Central America.
I feel like you still have to be careful there because, what was it, the story with the whaleback, where for years they thought they'd found the right vessel, and then they found, a manufacturer's plaque on the vessel, and it wasn't the right vessel?
Yeah, on that one, it was the manufacturer's plate on the engine with the serial number that verified that it wasn't City of Everett.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that, like, you're looking for an iron sidewheel steamer, and, like, you find that. Like, you've probably got the right vessel, but until you have positive ID, I guess you can't really be sure.
Yeah, and in this case, like many ships from this era, that positive ID does finally come when they identify the ship's bell. That one's pretty conclusive. Yes, this is the ship we're looking for. Interestingly enough, we just talked about those probability weights and likelihoods. This, to me, I think is my favorite detail of the story. The location of the ship most closely matched the location given by Captain Herndon.
Interesting.
So this is surprising, obviously, given the weighted probabilities, but it is less surprising when you consider the human element. That's something we always do on this show. This is not a story about mechanisms and technology. This is also a human story. Quoting from Lawrence Stone again, quote, "In hindsight, it's apparent that the Central America scenario, based on Captain Herndon's position, was the most accurate of the three scenarios. Herndon was highly respected as a careful seaman and an excellent navigator. It appears that he was able to take a more accurate celestial fix on a sinking ship in the middle of a storm than the captain of the Ellen did after the storm cleared on a ship that was out of danger."
That is kind of funny.
I read that quote, and I honestly don't know if it's intended to be more praise of Herndon or shade on the captain of the Ellen.
I mean, I guess you do have to wonder, like, how important was that fix to the Ellen? Like, did it actually matter when they took it? Or it's like, oh, you know, sometimes when you're doing something, you're like, good enough is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Is it one of those scenarios for them?
It's possible. I mean, and also at the time, you know, the Ellen has to know we're in extremely deep water. Does it really matter where this thing is? Like, you're not going to find
it. Right. Yeah, like, I don't think, like, finding and raising the cargo of that vessel was something that was even in their minds.
Yeah, and, you know, in that moment. And there's the time aspect also. I mean, remember, this is taken the following morning after the ship has been moving around trying to pick up survivors. It would have been extremely difficult to have a perfect calculation of exactly where they were when that ship sank.
Right.
So a lot of elements in play. Again, it seems like it's most impressive that Herndon apparently was able to generate pretty accurate coordinates, even with all of these other factors in play, really attesting to his skill as a navigator.
Yeah, definitely.
And he's displaying sort of all of the best of the skills you want as a captain. He's got his leadership, kind of the more intangibles, and then also like the hard skills of things like navigation.
Right.
So, kind of like you mentioned a few minutes ago, the story of the Central America, unlike some ships, it only gets more complicated once we actually know where it is. That initial mystery is solved, and then it just gets crazier. So to back things up a little bit, I want to talk about the team that discovered the wreck. So this team was led by Tommy Thompson, not the politician. And Bob Evans.
Say it. Not the restaurateur.
Not the restaurateur. So for those outside of the United States, I don't know how familiar Bob Evans will be, but very funny, I think, to American listeners.
It is just so everyone's aware, it's a breakfast restaurant chain / purveyor of sausage in grocery stores.
Yeah. Anyway, we got Tommy Thompson and Bob Evans. Thompson is essentially the idea man behind everything. It's kind of his plan. It's his idea. He's the one who has the motivation to look for this vessel.
Nothing could go wrong when it's just headed up by an, quote, idea man who just, you know, has great ideas, but none of the financial capital.
Yeah, those are always the best people. His job basically to convince investors to support this project. This is an expensive endeavor he's undertaking. You're in very, very deep water. You need a lot of sonar stuff. And remember, we're backing up. This is before they know where it is. This is he's having to basically blindly convince people that, hey, I know how to find this ship. When we discover this ship, I know exactly what's on it, and I know that it's going to be worth this much money, so you should give me an investment. That's a pretty like hefty task to convince someone of. I mean, this is like well beyond Shark Tank levels of having to convince someone to invest in your thing.
This is like some 1800s level of like, sponsor me on my expedition as I go to, you know, like find natural resources from an uncharted land.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're venturing into that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that really does highlight, though, how valuable the stuff is on this vessel. The fact that he's able to get people to invest in this, obviously there's a huge payoff potentially. It's worth noting that, you know, given the historical value of the items that are on the wreck, things like these coins that are on it, the actual value of the treasure potentially is far, far higher than its raw currency value. Like even adjusting for inflation, just the fact that these are these old minted coins, these are going to sell for millions of dollars if you can salvage these.
Right.
Things.
I mean, I think some of these things, like what's the value of some of these coins? It's literally whatever someone will pay for it.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a chest of 500 coins and each one is going to sell for upwards of $1 million, that's going to be worth quite a bit of investment to get at.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, obviously if you're listening to this podcast, you're into shipwrecks. If you were into shipwrecks and had the financial means to acquire those coins, like it doesn't matter what it's going to cost, you're going to buy them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So ultimately, there were 13 backers in this venture. They were each promised 1.975% of the recovery value.
Interesting that he couldn't go to 2.
I guess. And to me, like initially that was like, oh, well, that's like nothing, like not even 2%. But then again, thinking of how much money you're talking about here, you know, 2% of $100 million is I would take that, you know. Someone wanted to give me that. The initial 40-day search cost about $1.1 million. Eventually, there would be a lot more money poured into this because that first search didn't really find anything. But again, testament to Tommy Thompson as a convincer, I guess is a polite term to use. He was able to get more money out of these people saying, no, trust me, like I will find this thing.
Also, a great sign that you're in a great investment scheme is when the person's like, hey, I know you already gave me some money, but now I need more to get you your money.
Exactly.
Like he's like doing the Nigerian prince scam, but it's
exactly. So on discovery, so once obviously this was successful, we've established that they were able to find this. On discovery, though, there's another hurdle to get over. So in 1857, when the ship goes down, yes, it's a lot of money, but all of this stuff is also insured.
Uh-oh.
So here we get into another fun part. So when this was discovered, you know, this treasure was salvaged. I think I saw 39 different insurance companies claimed bits of the treasure as theirs, saying we paid claims on this in 1857 when it went down. So this is
I'm really hoping ours. That like all these various companies were like employing their interns to like go back through the company history and figure out how they could possibly claim to be this company from the 1850s.
You know? Jake from State Farm is just like on the phone.
Like they're pouring through old transaction records from like the 1900s to figure out who acquired who and like how they can still claim it.
Jake from State Farm and Flo are just like going at it over this treasure.
Also the motorcycle Cyclops.
Yes. The motor.
Yeah, I hate that. I hate that commercial so much.
So eventually in 2000, so this is a good amount of time that this legal battle goes on. In 2000, the team was awarded the bulk of the share of the treasure due to their initiative, ingenuity, and determination. Basically, the judge just decides, hey, like nobody would have any money if these people didn't go through the effort of getting it. So I think the insurance companies got like a relatively paltry amount of money. And most is awarded to this search team.
I think that makes sense because, like, if you're the insurance company and you really wanted that, employ a search team to go find it.
Go get it yourself, Jake.
I mean, otherwise, I would think. I mean, I'm sure the judge. I didn't read the ruling, but I'm sure it's essentially saying like you've abandoned any claim to this by showing no initiative and trying to recover.
Yeah, it's like I know it's not like a legal precedent. You can't really use this in court, but it's just one of those like, come on.
There probably are some laws actually though in place that like if you're not have shown some attempt at trying to recover this, then like de facto you've abandoned. Mm-hmm. That happens a lot with like property and things like that. Like where if someone's squatting on your property for X number of time, you never try to evict them from it. Mm-hmm. Like they can kind of get a legal claim to that.
Mm-hmm. So remember how I said that it was awarded to the team?
Yes. Yes. The whole team.
The whole team. Problem. In 2000, Thompson sold a large portion of the treasure for $50 million.
That's interesting.
And disappeared.
Huh. Shocker. He seemed like such an upstanding guy.
His team and his investors never saw any of that money. So he pulled the old, I don't know, is that a bait and switch or is that just a switch? I don't know what that is.
I think that's called just selling off enough to make sure that you don't have to work anymore and leaving.
So he basically unable to be found. Some of the articles now that come up when you search for this are written at a time when he's still missing. No one knows where he is. He was ultimately arrested by U.S. Marshals in 2015 at a hotel room in West Palm Beach, Florida.
I just have to wonder why this guy was so hard to find.
And why are you still here? Why are you still in the U.S.?
I would be finding like, a way to get to Argentina or Brazil or somewhere, anywhere.
Panama! We didn't go... Why not? I don't know. So skipping over the bulk of the details, we're already running a little bit long here. All the details of like the court cases and the arrests, those are all pretty widely available online. So I'm going to cut those things out a little bit. Where we stand now, in 2018, he was ordered to turn over 500 gold coins that were rescued from the wreck, and he agreed to do so. But 2 days later, I love this part of the story. 2 days later, I'm quoting from the Columbus Dispatch in 2018. He was from Ohio, so a lot of Ohio papers cover this. Quote, in testimony so meandering that the Franklin County Common Pleas judge interrupted several times to instruct Thompson to directly answer the questions, the 66-year-old former Battelle scientist suggested that the trust holding the coins likely wouldn't respond to any inquiries because of ongoing litigation over the treasure he recovered from an 1857 shipwreck. He also couldn't identify the stranger who took the coins from his then-girlfriend in the lobby of a self-storage business in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in 2010. He couldn't recall the details of the exchange other than making plans on the phone and said that the stranger presumably deposited the coins in Belize, where Thompson had set up a trust.
Can you imagine making $50 million for being like, I don't know who I sold them to, man?
It's like, so where'd you put that chest of gold coins you had? It's like, I don't know. I gave them to some guy in the lobby of a storage unit business.
That's some real Florida man energy in that, like just doing business in a storage unit business.
I'm sure the guy tried to take it to the Pawn Stars people. And he's like, best I can do is $20.
I can give you $20. These aren't in great condition.
So long story short, Thompson remains in prison. The most recent like actual story I could find about him was from 2019. But being such a big name and such a big story, I figured that if any major updates happened, they would be readily available. He is still in prison. He still refuses to divulge the location of these coins. I think he's like almost in his 70s now.
I remember this story happening like in 2018, because like living in the Dayton area, you get a lot of like the news out of Columbus and everything too. Mm-hmm. And I remember this popping up on my radar and reading about it and thinking like, this is kind of a crazy story. Like you could almost do a whole like detailed podcast just on this like legal part.
Oh yeah. We talk a lot about movies, like things that should be movies on this podcast. This could be one. And you could cover the shipwreck in like 30 minutes and then have a good hour and a half, 2 hours of what comes next with the search and salvage. That's the long meandering story of the SS Central America. In terms of my final thoughts about it, as I always say, there's always various reasons that I like researching these episodes. This one was cool because it was a really wide range of stuff I had to read a little bit about. There's the shipwreck. I had to read about financial stuff, Panic of 1857. Didn't really know much about that.
The recovery, the math and all that went into the recovery.
Yeah, like mathematical, statistical concepts like search theory I had to read a lot about, mm-hmm. Which coincides again with economics. The technology, the legal stuff, all kinds of stuff in play in this episode. Specifically with the search theory, I thought was interesting because you had three different theories you're working from and none of them are entirely accurate or trustworthy. What it reminded me most of is like a mystery novel where mm-hmm. if the detective or whoever, if the first person they talk to knows all the information and gives it to the detective, well, you don't have a very good story, do you?
Right.
But as they talk to more people, you know, they're getting misinformation or disinformation in some cases. Whether it's something that we don't know or something that someone's intentionally covering up, the more of that misinformation that you get and, you know, weave together, you can kind of construct the truth out of it. Right. And that's kind of what we have in this search, you know, knowing little bits from different pieces, different levels of trust we're putting in those pieces, and eventually, you know, was ultimately successful in finding this thing. I thought that was a cool process, seeing how that worked. And how it worked with the human element of, you know, having to convince all of these people with money to let me do this thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's really interesting. This is by far like one of the most dynamic topics we've done as far as just covering so many different facets of, you know, expertise and everything.
Yeah. When I started researching this shipwreck and was reading about like the gold rush, I didn't expect this story to end in a hotel room in West Palm Beach.
Or selling coins at a storage unit.
Yeah. Like, that's not where I thought this was going to go.
It's definitely an interesting one. I'm glad we did this one.
Mm-hmm. Any final comments, final thoughts?
I don't think so. No, it's just a really interesting story. It's, like you said, didn't expect it to end where it did, but, I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we could cover it. And I hope that everybody listening, enjoyed this one.
Same here. That was a fun one to do. Hope you enjoy it. We'll be releasing this one shortly. And just have a good week. Take care, everyone. And we will be back next week with some more material for you.